Okay, better late than never. Here's our episode for the missing episode for this week.
Apologies for the delay. We are aware of the backlog.
Yeah. It's busy December.
It really is. Yeah.
Chris, today, South Korea pulled off the improbable. Congratulations, Jess, if you've been rooting for the South Korean team.
Last I heard, they were knocked out of the running. So I didn't really pay much attention, to be honest. So what happened?
It was they were on the bubble, so to speak, and Ooh. They pulled it off by winning in injury time, meaning like the official 90 minutes had already passed, and uh-huh. they were all tied up with Portugal.
Oh wow! 1-1,
which is not a good enough result. Portugal would advance either way. They could lose in advance, mm-hmm. but they were tied at 1-1, and in injury time, you know, just sort of the fluff time at the end, mm-hmm. South Korea scored a pretty magnificent goal.
Man, that must have been quite a game.
And Son, what's his name? Sung, I don't know how to say his name.
Haemin, I think. Yeah.
Sung Haemin. Yeah.
Yeah.
He set it up, and it was pretty. He was like three defenders Beautiful. On him, and he was just pulling off his the Son magic. So congratulations awesome. To South Korean fans. Everyone I see on Twitter that follows them is losing their fucking mind because it was such an improbable and great game, and. Chris is watching it in Korea, so he's mm-hmm. probably a fucking mess right now. So very happy for Chris that he is in Korea to witness that.
Shout out to our man on the ground, Chris.
Yeah, yeah. So good timing for him. He missed. He had to like you know he wanted to go see Son I think in the UK. Mm-hmm. But COVID got in the way of that and stuff. So. He didn't get lucky with that trip, but I think he got pretty lucky with this one.
Yeah, sounds like a hell of a game to have caught. Yeah. But yeah. Anyway, he'll be doing a pod when he comes back to recap his trip.
Yes.
Probably a lot of World Cup news in there too.
Yeah, he's back Sunday, and Sunday's like the wrap up day for shooting on the short film that Dan Chen has been and Millie and this guy Phillips and a whole bunch of other crew and stuff.
Yeah, there seem to be a bunch of people involved. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's gonna be like about five continuous days of like and these guys get up at the crack ass of dawn. Me and Chan woke up to drive them over to Ron Kim's place this morning to meet him at 6:30. So I had to get up at like 5:20.
Dang.
And I'm probably not going to see them until like, you know, they're probably not going to walk into the apartment until like well after 11. And, you know, and they're walking all day with these cameras and sound booms and, you know, all this shit. Mm-hmm. And it's real dedication. Like, this ain't like making a YouTube video where, you know, you got a guy with like an iPhone on a gimbal. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like real fucking crazy, you know. Like mobile production unit stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really exciting.
Have they been eating okay?
No.
No?
they don't have time. They eat like one meal a day.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's pretty... They go into like combat mode, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning...
Yeah, when you're in the zone, you gotta do what it takes to stay in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to tell you about the dinner that we had the first night. It was such a cool way to kick off this film project. Okay, so like I pick Dan and Phillips up from the airport, and the first thing we do after that is we meet a bunch of people from like Dragon Combat Club over at Louis Pizza, which is like three blocks from me. Louis Pizza is the place where like Louis Soljevic is the guy who owns the place along with his father, and it's like the lone like Italian outpost in a sea of like Colombian restaurants and, you know, Thai restaurants. It was like the one Italian restaurant around here. And there was that elderly Korean lady that was being robbed outside the front. They had an interview. You know this, but I'm just saying this for the audience. Mm-hmm. And then Louis and his father like ran out to intervene, and they got stabbed repeatedly. His father got stabbed 9 times, and both of his lungs collapsed. Ended up in the hospital, which is thankfully right across the street. And Louis was bleeding all over the place, but he closed up the restaurant and then walked himself over to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
Just classic like tough New Yorkers, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I had told Louis about the project and he was interested in being interviewed for it and everything. And so I was like, yo, I'm gonna bring these guys over for dinner. We're gonna have like a kickoff dinner here if that's cool. And it's not just pizza, like they make like a full Italian menu with like all sorts of like pasta dishes and seafood and steak dishes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So a full on Italian restaurant.
It is. And yeah. I think it might be one of like the true hidden gems of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've experienced the food, because his father was a professional chef at a couple famous Italian restaurants in Midtown back mm-hmm. in the day. So he's got the
oh,
he's
that's
got
saying
the
something.
Yeah.
Italian in Midtown, yeah,
yeah,
that's the real shit. Yeah,
yeah, he's got chops, right? And so he still is just, you know, his father's the one that's cooking up all these amazing dishes, and you know, for like 8 people. It was like $135.
Dude. I
mean, how can you, you know? And like, Shan had a full-on ribeye steak cooked perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Delicious. Did you think, baby, was the steak good?
Yeah, everybody loved it.
I could tell. Yeah, I wasn't there, but I knew it was good because all the pictures that you took inside the restaurant, all of the plates were like clean, like licked clean.
Yeah. Yeah, you get like 3 pieces of bread to mop it up with, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. We're talking like you like that tells you something about how good this joint is.
Yeah. So the food's perfect. But the other thing is like Louis, you know, comes out. Oh, there's like this, you know, there's this like it was like a scene out of like a Do the Right Thing kind of scene where the other customers in the restaurant were like talking to us.
Oh, that's awesome.
And involved in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like this other guy who was like from Manhattan, and he goes all the way there to eat because he's friends with Louis' dad, and he's talking to us, asking us what we're doing here, and we're telling him about the film project, and he's all excited because he used to work on a film crew. And then this Louis comes out and he's monologuing for us, and his father comes out, and his father's like, you know, when you start, everyone's like just, you know, telling the chef how great he is, and he's just sitting there taking it with that big ass face. And then, you know, and then he's like, hey, who's the filmmaker here? And Dan raises his hand and everything. And then there's just like straight up talk about like Louis comes out and he starts laying, like, I wish we filmed this, but maybe it's better that we didn't film it because it became more natural. But like Louis was just laying down his thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about what is going on in the city.
Oh, yeah.
And everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just everyone. And then people are responding. And then Adam is like, you know, when this thing goes down, when these things go down, you know, who are you supposed to call? Who are you going to call? And this mm-hmm. random guy just eating a piece of pizza in the corner is like, Ghostbusters, you know, and he starts jumping in with his thoughts. And like that, this is not a typical New York City dinner experience, you know, mm-hmm. but it is a classic one in that sense, if that's meaningful at all. And so that was just a great kickoff. Like these two guys come in from LA and immediately get transported into like Asian Italian Do the Right Thing, you know. it was absolutely perfect dinner for.
Yeah, when those things go right, man, those things are magical. Like,
yeah,
part of it, like, I like eating out. But part of it feels very impersonal too, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you go to a nice place, but you're not really paying attention to anybody. You're not supposed to, right? No one's paying attention to you. You kind of do your thing. You get out. Just once in a while, you hit like a the right note, and something really like besides just great food, just comes alive. You get good conversation. You meet interesting people. When it's right, it's so right. Sounds like you guys hit that note.
It was like the New York City ideal, you know, the ideal version of like a Vienna coffee house, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then people are monologuing political ideas, you know, and you're like, wow.
Like, no, this is what's wrong. No, this.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Just great energy. And then they're out actually with Chong right now, Bretillon over at LIC.
Mm-hmm.
And timing was great because she got COVID and it was like kicking her butt.
Oh no.
But now I think she's recovered enough where she's feeling good. And then I just saw her lose her shit on Twitter when South Korea won. So I'm like, she's in a good mood.
Perfect. Perfect.
Losing her shit on Twitter. I'm like, she's having a good time. Losing her shit and thirsting after the boys.
Right? Of course. It's easy to do.
Just the open, just like shameless thirsting for this Korean national team is hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just shameless women and men, you know, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So it occurs to me that we didn't actually tee up the film project itself. We just talked about it.
Oh, I'm just catching up with you, Jess.
Yeah. Y'all are just listening in. So yeah. In case,
oh, and happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Belated.
Another year of contemplating mortality in the bag, ready for another one.
You know, getting older is great. It's fucking awesome.
It really is, honestly. Yeah. It seemed like such a cliche. Okay, like a major tipping point was 30, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I was dreading turning 30, like especially as a woman, you know. But I think generally you're kind of trained to be a little angsty about these sorts of things, especially in a really hyper like youth fetishizing culture, right? Like once the clock turned over on 30. It was so much better. Everything that they say about that was dead on.
What did they say about it? What primarily?
I thought it was a little bit of cope, honestly, from like people who were over 30 saying like, "Oh no, your 30s are the best. You stop giving a fuck. You know, you're more self assured. You got a little bit like credibility in your bit. Like the
word. You weren't totally buying it.
I wasn't buying it. Like, how could you be? You're old now. What's left for you in life, honestly? But no, it was true. Like, this is predicated on spending your 20s correctly, right? Like, I think the 20s for everyone is kind of a grind.
Mm-hmm.
I think men talk about it a lot, and it's very acute for them. But it's not like women are that far off from that either, especially if you're in like a white collar situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where everyone pretty much just goes through the same like education track at the same age. Your 20s are kind of a grind. You don't have enough money. You're not that respected at your job. You're not that good at your job yet. You're precarious in a lot of different ways. You're insecure, you're anxious, you know, a lot of things don't, you know, aren't going so great. If you handle that period correctly, like turning 30 and beyond, is amazing.
Yeah. Yes.
And you're not.
I agree.
And you're not like. And you're still like. It's not like your body completely falls apart or anything either. So you still get like. It's not that much different than. It's kind of like delaying all the things that people say that they wanted to do or that you should be doing in your 20s, and then pushing it back until you actually have like the means and the stability to be able to do it. It's great. Yeah.
I think a hybrid.
And you really actually,
I think 30s is neither young nor old. It's kind of both.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like an old, you could either be, I think the early half of the 30s, you're an old young person. And then the later half of the 30s, you're a young old person.
That feels correct. Which means you kind of tap into both worlds, so to speak.
Yes.
And definitely you have to handle the mental transition well. Like you can't be like, you got to move past like the impulsivity, you know, the YOLO in your 20s. You got to be able to manage it because you are a grown adult at this point. But it's not like you have to immediately go to, you know, hemorrhoid cream and looking up old folks homes, you know?
You're right. Right.
So I don't know. So moving through my 30s has been awesome.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
40s is its own trip too, but it's in a
way,
it's different because 40s, you're just like straight up, just accept that you're old. Don't try to, you know, don't be confused about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of confused people in their 40s who are still kind of hanging
I think
on
the
to
humor in your thirties, like I follow this Twitter account. I am 30 as fuck. So I am 30 AF. Right. It's hilarious. I like every single meme that I come across, I identify with. A lot of it is kind of being in a little bit of denial that your proclivities have changed, right? From your 20s. Right. Like who is this bitch, you know, going to bed with a book at 9 p.m., you know, YOLO, stuff like that. Yeah. Well, like it is a period of like you have to be mindful about this, right? You have to handle that transition. I think it's sad when people who hit a certain age and are in complete denial of it, or they're trying to extend a period of life that has absolutely passed them by. Right. Like this isn't even like arrested development. This is intentionally keeping yourself in a state of arrested development, not letting yourself progress as is natural for everyone to do. It's fruitful. It's not just like coming to grips with getting old. There are actual, like, to me, benefits in having been on this earth for a certain period of time, having done my thinking, having been critical, having done the work. And you reap the rewards of that. There's people out there who are just simply getting older in body and like refusing to open their minds up.
Yeah. You know, in a way it's all, and there's a little bit of a reverse thing going on too, where I think like older people these days, some of them, maybe not these, I always say these days, maybe it's a universal, but like it always happens, but like older people still, kind of staying trendy and trying to update their style and preferences and stuff to match the times. And it's kind of like, it kind of goes against, like, in my opinion, the luxury of age, which is like, I can freeze my time. I can and should freeze my style and preferences to a certain point at which I like, and then just become like hopelessly outdated. And that makes you like a proper old person. You know what I mean? Like, you should be unstylish to a degree.
You a person, right? Who are you if your life is and your tastes are dictated by things around you, right? If you feel you have to adapt yourself to the things around you, you're not really a full actualized person. I think by a certain age, you are inevitably going to develop preferences, right? I think we talked about this in the materialism pod. Like, I have very defined preferences now. I am probably never going to diverge from that, no matter what the trends around me say.
Right.
If you want to buy that as like being intentionally unstylish or like curmudgeonly or just being an old person, sure. That comes with that. But part of it is like, who the fuck are you to tell me how I need to live my life?
But I think people like it when they see it. We just don't see it that much. Like, I don't know. I was watching this old Mike Myers skit from SNL. Like, he had a little character called Middle-Aged Man from like way long ago. And it's this like deeply unfashionable middle-aged guy who goes around solving problems for people in the suburb neighborhood that he lives in. Because as a deeply unfashionable middle-aged man who's like going bald and has all sorts of like back issues, he has a lot of practical knowledge. Like, he'll just show up at your garage and tell you how to jumpstart a car and, you know, like when to remove the cables and, you know, all this stuff, and maybe to put some baking soda on the terminals to prevent corrosion in the future, that kind of thing. And the existence of these unfashionable but highly like practically knowledgeable middle-aged adults, it's starting to disappear a little. And now like middle-aged adults are trendy. They're on fashion. They're keeping up with trends. And I kind of miss Mike Myers' middle-aged man. You know, I miss the hopelessly, you know, adult, I don't get the youth culture kind of guy or lady, but who just has like a lot of practical knowledge that the kids do not have. Does that, you know what I mean? I don't know. That's how I thought of adults when I was a kid. And now all the adults are fashionable.
I see a through line from this into the actual topic.
Yeah, let's get to the top.
No, but like, what you're talking about is like someone who's very set in their ways, and probably means that in their day-to-day like mindset, they are not focused on the world around them to some degree, right? Like, if you want to be trendy or stylish, you have to care about that entire world, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a trade-off. You can't be on top of every trend, be, you know, stay current and hip and everything, and also have the mental capacity to like build up a body of knowledge in a certain, be an obsessive about something. Like this guy clearly just tunneled in to what is it, just like car shit or like general, like
anything,
just general
like marriage stuff, you know. Okay. Like this woman asks him if her husband's having an affair, and he's like, does he seem especially happy lately? And she's like, no, he's like, he's not having an affair.
Yeah.
Shit like that.
Yeah. Like there's an element of caring about the world that that you have to come to terms with. And I think a big part of it is not even telling you not to care about what other people say. Like that's not for anyone to say, right? Mm-hmm. Or that you absolutely should be tailoring your life around the trends around you. It's simply you have to come to terms with what you care about, and try to find that balance for yourself. So I think this tees us up into the conversation about strivers versus obsessives. Yes. Both of these things I feel like have been kind of meta themes in stuff we've talked about, but we tend to emphasize more on the striverness, the striver portion of it. We've kind of like especially in the Discord, if y'all hop on in, you'll see, you know, it's basically a daily staple of conversation, you know, grappling with this concept of the striver, like how much should I be striving, how much of it is good to do, how much of it is bad. A lot of our energy is actually spent on bashing strivers who are willing to throw like the community under the bus, throw a specific subset under the bus for their own personal gain, etc. Striver is kind of the person who wants to stay hip to things. They very much care about how they relate to the outside world and they are very concerned with how the outside world sees them, right?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it plays into things like materialism, right? I think we've gone back and forth on this a lot, actually. But I think like striverism is often, you can often tell by their lifestyles, right? Buying a very hip car, right? Having to live in a house that's slightly over, you know, slightly less than affordable for you, right? Like really pushing the limits on that. And it's really to project an image of yourself. And I think the hope
a lot of like internet connected, like exercise gear that requires like a subscription, that kind of
thing.
There
you go. Yeah. The Peloton. Yeah. Like there's a whole like axis, like Peloton, Tesla, and probably something else that I'm missing, but
yeah, it's all the hot brands.
It's all the hot brands. Yeah. Everybody that slid into the inbox with a sans serif font, basically. Oh, Casper mattresses, Tesla and Peloton or something. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about marketing because it's so obvious because they've done the work to tap into the psychology of this customer, right? A little class anxious, not wealthy, right? All of them offer like payment plans,
financing,
right?
Yeah.
Financing for these, for these entirely optional, things.
I think these are high income people, but who are spending.
Yes. They spend, they spend what they make.
Yeah.
It should seem weirder than it does. Like, I don't hear anybody but us talking about it. Like how Peloton has a payment plan. Like you can finance your Peloton.
Yes, you can. Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you can finance your pants. From what
I mean, it's certainly expanded way past that. But like to me, I think for us, right? Like I think you pointed out that holy shit, you can finance a Peloton or something, and like that's an odd thing. And like just think, and I think a lot of our conversation about striving is entirely about like getting into the psychology. Who is that customer? Basically, we want to talk about everyone who has financed a Peloton. Basically,
yeah.
I don't, and we're pretty anti-striver in this dojo. I feel like that's worth getting into a little. I think it's without a proper articulation of what we're saying. I think it just sounds like we're just kind of shitting on people who've made it to a certain point in life, right? And kind of shitting on like the psychological struggle of that kind of precarious middle class. But I think what we're talking about, if I'm going to go on out on a limb, I'd hazard the guess that when we talk about being anti-striving, we are talking about to some extent cutting off the hold that the outside world has on
not us. The person, right? We're not shitting on the person, I don't think, but we're talking about the cultural reinforcement and even the cultural underpinnings that are pressuring people into sort of an endless striverism, and the symbolism of, you know, financing a bike that you work really hard to pedal, but which goes nowhere. You know, like financing a stationary bike is it's such a perfect metaphor for this culture, you know, but anyway.
Yeah. And you have to pay, it turns out you have to pay a subscription for their like their group classes. And they're very exquisitely engineered things that kind of tap into your like competitive instinct, right? Like you're scored against the rest of your class, and then you know, you're supposed to like work harder to get to the top of the class, right? For nothing, right?
Just for the feels.
Just for the feels to get you to. I mean, they're trying to trick you into burning more calories, right? Which is ostensibly the thing you're trying to do, right? Like get in shape, all that good stuff. But the reasoning behind it is so hilarious, and it is such a perfect metaphor, right? Like striving affects all of us in basically every aspect of our lives, right? We talk about striving in terms of like the college rat race, and I think Asians have been in the spotlight in particular for that too. And it's been a really tricky kind of conversation to navigate here, like being anti-striving, but also, you know, but also negotiating affirmative action, all that stuff. But it is such a hot button issue. It is such a critical issue because striving to get into an elite institution does kind of set you up for a certain kind of life that is desirable in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I think striving also affects us in our career choices, right? We like in tech, I've personally been really, I don't know if anyone actually like fully gets my like why I disliked this so much. And I don't intend to go into a full thing on that, but for a long time, the status symbol was to get a job at the FANGs. For anyone who doesn't know, like the big five companies whose names everyone knows, like Facebook, Apple, what's the other A?
Amazon,
right. Netflix, although a lot of these companies are a little bit on the rocks, but they've been the premier employers in this industry for like a decade.
And stock price superstars for sure. Mm-hmm. Minting right. Millionaires and billionaires.
Millionaires, honestly. Yeah. And we can argue about, you know, what that actually means in these high cost of living cities, but these jobs carry cachet, status, and a lot of material security. Right, you could make a lot of money, very very safely if you get access to a job there. Now, all of that has come into question in recent years, especially with all the layoffs and stock prices slipping, and you know, all this stuff has kind of come home to roost. But for a while, that absolutely was the thing to strive for if you were a like software engineer in the industry. Like that was the apex of your career aspirations. If you weren't, you know, psycho enough to want to go off and do a startup and kind of like gun, you know, take a run at the king himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me
pose a question, right? Yeah. Which I think is at the heart of the topic that you proposed, which is, okay, if we're against or if we're trying to critique striverism in our culture and in our lives, what is the antithesis to it? And it sounds like, you know, you were talking about obsessives, and yes. I don't know if you mean that as sort of the antithesis or an antithesis to striverism, but what is obsessiveness? What are obsessives?
I think it's a despised shadow to the striver.
Okay, wow. Jungian terms.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to follow up on that. Just gut feeling is the way it, I thought of this as Striver versus Obsessive, not to imply that it's the only despised shadow like persona archetype to the Striver, but that it's one of them. And it's just what happens to be one that I feel particularly protective of, and I find it a shame that it's been so despised in the culture at large here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's bring it to the Asian subreddits, right? Our favorite place to start a conversation. Yeah. I feel like, leaving aside any like political or even like sociological thing that they're unpacking, one of the things that they seem to value are the traits and aspirations of the Striver. A lot of the like help that I see being peddled there is in fact about like stripping away a bit of individuality, kind of tapping into a hive mind collective consciousness of cool.
Get with the program.
Get with the program. Yeah. I mean, the goal is to get chicks, right? That seems to be like,
how many posts do you see that are like, hey, I'm thinking about moving to this city or that city. Which one is like best for pulling ladies? You know, that's like the number one criteria is, like, where am I going to get laid the most?
Yeah. I mean, that was a crazy one from just a couple days ago. Shout out Paluo, our resident trash collector who brings the choicest garbage to our door.
Yeah.
It was a post from a guy, an Asian guy at UCLA, a junior, in fact. And he's talking about how it's hard to pull hot Asian chicks at UCLA. And is actually contemplating transferring to a school that has more of the kinds of Asian girls that he's interested in. Mm-hmm. Schools that are ranked lower than UCLA. Like that's how far that
the ABGs.
Mm-hmm. No diss to UCI, honestly. That is the mothership. But that's not the most interesting part for the topic at hand. Part of it is he describes the process he personally went through to undergo this transformation into a ABG pickup machine. Right, talks about getting piercings, I think tattoos, getting in shape. Like he molded his entire personality around this vision of an ideal self. That he believed would give him the yield he was after, right? So this is striving, right? This is kind of a striver attitude, right? Striving is kind of shaving off individuality. It's putting aside individuality, putting aside things that go against the grain, break the mold a little bit, and to conform to a very inoffensive, maximally poised for success person.
Right.
A person like that is going to, like, it's, let's see. You're kind of turning yourself into a product for mass appeal, not niche appeal, right? Because we've decided in this instance that pulling, the most chicks and the hottest is the metric to win on.
And it requires a deep commitment to social conformity.
Yes, and, very much.
Yeah,
like internalizing it.
The hallmarks of that, the ideals of it, and what that looks like, are not up to you. I think that's part of that culture. Is like the whole point of it is to have external standards that we're all sort of put pressure upon to meet. Some more than others, and that's the game. We're playing the same game. And mm-hmm. the point of it is who can embody this better than and who can't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think is an element of that mentality. And I think you're right. I think that does sound very counter to the obsessive, who I think, I don't know, you said obsessive because I think there's a behavioral aspect to it, which is obsessive, but I think of it as creative.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think to hit a certain height of creativity or achievement, I think you have to be an obsessive. Like you cannot strive your way to genius. Seriously.
Right.
Because striverism is inherently about appeasing other people. And in return, they will give you like they will give you the trappings that you need to burnish your sense of self and to win some goal that you that you've optimized yourself for. Right. The obsessive does not give a single shit.
Yeah. I think genius is kind of there has to be creativity in it. Mm-hmm. Right. It can't be non. It's almost like the synonymous is the ability to create and whatever it is, art or some scientific theory or some engineering thing, but there's a creation aspect to it. And what you're saying is, I think what we're arriving at is this idea that, well, if you're defining yourself in this way of saying like, here, this is what society values. And by society, I mean chicks that I like, you know, and other dudes who want to be like me. Right. Because they also like the chicks. There's no creativity in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
There may be hacks, but that's not creative, right? There may be like tips, shortcuts, but you know, ultimately, because the goal, I think, is beyond your own control, you don't get to define those goals. It's just the best path from here to there. There's like no room for genius. There's no room for creativity.
You can't afford the risk that creativity demands.
Right.
You have to be as riskless as possible. That means conforming to a well-known template. Mm-hmm. It's an anti-creative process, really. And success is determined completely by other people, right? There is no internal metric for it. The validation and the confirmation of your success is entirely externalized.
Right.
And it's a process of you valuing that validation enough to bring that in and internalize that as part of your sense of self.
Well, then let's talk about that's instead, because I think the striver is so well known. Like we all know mm-hmm. it, we all have it. Like, and I don't think the world is necessarily divided between striver individuals and creative, obsessive individuals. But I think we all probably have a degree of both in each of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like all of us absolutely. Have a striver side. All of us have a creative side. And that aligns with you saying stuff like the despised shadow in Jungian terms, in that Jung has always, you know, it's all about archetypes and we have it. They're all in us. We have all of it in ourselves to varying degrees. Right.
Yeah.
And so this isn't to call out like a specific group of people like you guys suck and then saying, oh, but those creative people over there are awesome. At least I don't think that's what it is. But more that there's a tendency, there's a pressure to be conformist and striverist. And there's also an inner drive, I would say, to be, I don't know if you think that's a difference is like that obsessives that's an inner drive. That's not yes. like an outer pressure to do the thing that you're obsessive about, be it some like filmmaking, and I'm watching Dan and Phillips like and Millie like just be. I mean, like Millie, like in the morning she has to get to Flushing or Elmhurst, my place, by like 6:30 or 7 in the morning, all the way from where she lives, which is really far away. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, oh, you know, I feel sorry that this project is making her do that, but she's just like, no, it's fine. And she's just like dragging these boxes and stuff. And I'm like, that's probably inner drive. That's obsessive behavior where she wants to do it.
Yeah, it makes no rational sense. That's the thing.
It doesn't
right?
make any sense. I'm like, that's a nightmare like, schlep.
Obsessive,
you know?
Yeah. Like the path of an obsessive. And I'm talking about like if you are gripped by the muse, right? It makes no sense. You are doing this almost at your own expense, right? You will sacrifice your own like you're saying that even taking care of my own body is second to the comforts of bed and being comfortable and warm on a winter morning is very secondary to getting this shit done.
Right.
Right. It shouldn't make any sense. There's a
do you feel that in your life? Like, do you feel like you have elements of your life that are of you that are striver and elements that are obsessive? And if so, like, which is the real you? You know what I mean? Like, do you think about that kind of stuff? Or
I absolutely do. I think being in tech is kind of a weird head trip in that sense.
Because right. A lot of this is technology centered based on like what you've talked about.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, not to imply it's the only one. It just happens to be the one I know best. So I'd love to bring like Dan or Millie to talk about it from their perspective too at some point. But there's a lot of myths and contradictions inherent to being somebody who works in tech, someone who works in software or anything, honestly. All right. It's an industry that's founded on the myth of the obsessive, like valorizing the true obsessive, the genius, right? The social outcasts that hacked against all reason for like 5 years and then came up with something that literally changed the world. And that is the story for a lot of stuff. That's the story of like the C language, right? For example, that's just one of many. The C programming language, right? Didn't make any sense for them to have done all that, but they did, and we use it every day. Every single one of us. If you're on a device, you're working with any kind of appliance or computer or phone or anything, you are using C. You are using the fruits of that labor. Where am I going with this? So it's an industry that deeply valorizes this, right? And the myth making is about, you know, the antisocial, probably autistic or borderline autistic person who just lives in a hoodie and just wants to write code all day. The reality is something a lot different, right? The reality, especially now in a bureaucratized, very capital rich industry, is primarily marked by how much striving you can do that mimics obsession.
That mimics obsession. That's intentionally trying to be mistaken for.
Yeah. Borrowing the valor of the true obsessives, right? The Ken Thompsons, the Dennis Ritchies of the world. I have an interesting story about Ken Thompson, I think, later on to demonstrate the contradiction, one of the contradictions here.
Yeah.
So you borrow the trappings, like a lot of people, you know, brag openly about having ADHD or like talking about themselves on the Asperger's, the autism spectrum or something like, but it is kind of an act for a lot of people.
Right.
So it has become really hard to tell. And credentialism is endemic. So, I think like going to a good college, it's not really a marker of genius. It is a marker of a certain kind of discipline and self-effacement at a certain age. Like if you're able to be.
What do you mean by self-effacement?
The process to get into a college, right, is peak striver. Mm-hmm. Is there any actual room for individualism in the process that we have today? No.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I know a lot of people, true, like people I actually would consider geniuses with no hyperbole, right, who did not go to college. Like one of them like quit halfway through the application process, or one of them could not pull together the grades to get to a decent college in high school, because the way education works rewards striving, not obsession. Right. So like this guy was like. He had taken over like the school AV department. So he was like doing hardware hacks and writing software for all this stuff and like flunked English, right? Stuff like that. Hello?
Right. But then for like truly obsessive types, where that is like the dominant, you know, their dominant mode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm trying to formulate a question around this. Like, do you think that they care about striverism? Like, is it something that they're out to like, you know, have a chip on their shoulder about or whatever, or do they ignore it? They don't care. They find it irrelevant and they just want to not think about that. They want to think about the thing that they care about.
I think the latter, and it's just when the endemic striverism is interfering with their flow, that it gets to be a problem.
Right. And what are the what do you think? I think one of the hallmarks of
it's antisocial. It's an antisocial perspective. You are literally saying, "I don't give a fuck about your opinion." That's not exactly a thing that, like, if a critical mass of people felt like this, that means that we're all psychopaths and society is broken down. Right?
Antisocial within a striver society.
Yes,
but it's not asocial in the sense that it's inherently against social connections, I would think, right? Like,
no, not inherently.
Isn't a lot of, like, hacker culture, like the real, not the bullshit hacker culture now, but like the real original hacker culture that did create stuff like C, like, very social. Like, it was a very, it was very communal. Like, it wasn't these sequestered, you know,
it's like great collaborative
clerics, you know, these clerks, you know, just hiding away in some, like, spider hole working on their craft in total anonymity. But there was a community. There was a lot of sharing and strong social bonds that were part of that culture, too, right? It's not just individuals, you know, grinding away in total isolation.
Yes, it is extremely collaborative and social within that sphere, right? Antisocial, given that there are always going to be more people who are not like that than who are like that, and that's probably healthy for society. I don't think we could sustain a society where everyone is that level of antisocial obsessive. Like, you need both.
Well, here's the thing, though. I mean, I think that We're talking about obsessives as if they're an elite or rare group because they're marked by genius, right? And I think that the ones that we pay attention to do have, like, you know, neural atypical levels of, like, aptitude towards some creative pursuit, because maybe, like, that's the inner drive, the strength, the sort of, like, outsized inner drive that they have cannot be suppressed by the pressures, the intense pressure, even the intense pressures of a striver society like we live in America, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But would you agree that, I don't know why I'm asking this like a fucking lawyer. Would you agree that actually, you know, I think almost all people have creative drives, even if you're not, like, a genius, you know, like, even if you're not, like, exceptionally gifted, like, everyone has creative obsessions, like, everyone has interests, but we just don't really have the time or place for that stuff anymore. And only those that have intense drives will, like, forcefully carve out space and be hyper protective of their time, which I think is a hallmark of obsessive these days, is, like, they're extremely defensive of their time and how they spend it. And they're very averse to people telling them what to do and how and when.
Extremely so. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we used to just call them hobbies, right? Interests.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone has their quirks, their individual perspectives and interests, right? I love seeing that stuff. And it absolutely is an indictment on the society we live in when that, even that stuff gets so costly, either in money or time or cognitive effort. It takes a lot of work just to have your own shit together, like, just to have a take that isn't fed to you by the media machine, to like something that isn't part of some mainstream whatever. And I think a perversion of mainstream is actually taking stuff that used to be niche and then blowing them up, like comic book movies, for example. Mm-hmm. That used to be a really despised kind of hobby to have, like the schlubby nerd who goes to the comic book store and buys up, you know, every copy of Superman, or I don't know it. It's such an arcane world. That used to be kind of a despised thing, and now. And now Marvel is, like, the dominant film franchise on the planet, like, bar none. It used to be kind of nerdy to be into Star Wars. Now it's mainstream. But we still value things, like we still say we value things like individuality, you know, not giving a fuck about society, you know, going against the grain. So it's just kind of like, so these franchises kind of work to bring like some of that outsider cool, but make it mainstream. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of people who think that they are fighting the battle of some underdog by defending Marvel against all criticism. Like it's still some niche hobby that only the chosen few can truly understand. They still defend it like that when it's it's been the only film franchise basically in theaters for a decade plus now. Like, come on, how are we managing this head trip here?
Wait, I'm sorry. So what are you saying about Marvel? You're saying that it used to be the domain of obsessives, but now it's become...
Mm-hmm. But like, now it's become mainstream. It's become very normy. But part of its appeal, I think, is that it borrows the going against the grainness of its niche beginnings.
Oh, yeah. And I think like there's a lot of people now who are pretending like they were comic book nerds. And a lot of people who are pretending they were Star Wars nerds, but they weren't.
But it's become
a mark of having that sort of like nerdy authenticity. Mm-hmm. Like I was into this before it was cool, is this constant thing that Strivers do, which I think is pure Striver shit. Like they care about that for some reason. Like they care that they were the first to like something and that these trends are bullshit, but I'm the real thing and all this stuff. And that's what, you know, the other thing that I think is that's a hallmark of a Striver. I think the hallmark of a creative obsessive, if you've noticed, like at least the ones that are like vocally publicly vocal about what they do and why, is that the obsessive, especially the one who truly likes what she is in like doing, like just cares a lot about it, whatever it is, when they talk about it, have you ever noticed it's really easy to understand? Like,
yes,
they make things like I've listened to, like Ken Thompson seems to be a name that keeps coming up. Now, see, I think a lot of like self-styled techies won't know this name because they're not actually tech obsessives and they don't know who that is.
They're chasing glamour, they're chasing money, and all of those things, both of those things are highly Striver-ish. I mean, to put it in black and white terms, obviously, right, to chase those things implicitly involves giving a huge shit about what others think of you,
right?
And you're gauging success based on how many other people also bought into that vision. This is a very pro-social. This is a very pro-social view of things, of the industry, and how you see, where you see your place in it.
Yeah. And of course, like I doubt that any Striver techie bro guy actually is able to program in C. Pretty like, I guess, low level language.
It's like, why?
Yeah, why would you do that?
Just make everything in React and put the app out, bro.
Right. Who gives a shit? Right. Exactly.
We'll be popping bottles by the weekend.
Yeah. But you know, the interesting thing to me is like, okay, take someone like him who is, you know, one of the like fathers of modern computer science, right? And listen to his an interview that he's done with a channel like a Computer File or I think he's even been on like Lex Friedman, maybe, I'm not sure, but he makes the topic of computer science and programming very easy to understand in a way. Like he's dealing with first principles. He knows how to communicate this to a layperson in a way that the Striver techie bro intentionally obfuscates. The person who's doing, I don't even know what they do, but they
SBF. He was lauded for being a visionary and a genius, right?
Yeah, right.
He was being vague and used political trappings, like having the right political takes as a cover, right? Yeah,
for his lack of knowledge. And I think they like to talk about stuff where the point of it is that other people won't understand it, except for the in-group.
They are the chosen. You need to trust them. This is ultimately a trust currying exercise, right? You're selling an image that you want other people to buy.
Right. Right. They don't. Ken's they just don't here to want talk to about make computers. Sense. They want to make no sense, so that you will think that they're at a different level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that you'll never be able to understand what they're talking about. And that, to me, is the mark of a striver. Whereas when you listen to a true obsessive, they really passionately want to understand what it is they're doing. And so therefore, when they communicate it, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And even for someone like me, who is absolutely not a tech obsessive, but I'm not a tech striver, I'm not in tech at all, I really enjoy listening to the true obsessives talk, because they actually are intelligible and they care about making it make sense to you.
Yeah, and it's weird. It resonates weirdly. Yeah. The idea, like, they're actually trying to communicate a thing, not just tell you a PR pitch.
Not to talk to other strivers in front of you to flex.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's Sigma grindset shit. And I fucking hate that culture of ours. And it's taking over. And, you know, these people don't sound smart to me. They sound like fucking idiots. And they keep being exposed as idiots.
Yeah, complete frauds.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, when it comes to tech, for example, I mean, I've had training, right? Like, I was an electrical engineering major. I didn't go much further than that. But that is hard STEM training. And I can spot this shit from a mile away. You know, like, when you've been educated by engineering PhDs that are, like, deep into the shit, and then you hear these tech bros talking like they're, you know, the true obsessive tech people, I know you're full of shit. So
chances are what you're doing is far less sophisticated than what you're positioning it as. It's gonna be a horror to actually look upon. Like, one thing about, like, these hackers, like the original OG hackers, we talk about them as antisocial, blah, blah, blah. That implies a certain ideology that you would assume is imbued into their work. These guys all wanted to release software for free. They wanted this easily accessible, easily shareable, transferable. People would have full ownership over the work that they do. All they wanted out of this was to just put this out there.
Yeah. Right, because it made sense to them.
Yeah, it's the business mind that tries to corral value, enclose and entrap it.
Yeah.
So there's, in broad strokes, that is also a deep philosophical difference. Ken wants you to know about computer science.
Yeah.
He wants you to think like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll go check it out. And it makes it seem like you could pick this up and learn it and enjoy it and get some value out of it for yourself.
I think that as bad as things are in tech, I think it's even worse in the arts.
I believe so.
It's it's almost past the point.
Maybe we'll pivot into that. But I have one like little anecdote that I think is kind of fun, just to demonstrate, you know, how far the like tech has come as an industry and where it is right now, and how it clashes with the obsessive. Like we're gonna talk about Ken Thompson again. Here. So wait, let me check a second to see if I got that name correct. Anyway, so the story involves Google. I am pulling up Wikipedia. Okay,
wait, you're checking to see if Ken Thompson's the right name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I know he wrote C. I'm talking about this time I'm talking about Go. I think he was one of the authors of Go. Mm-hmm. The Go programming language. Okay. If I'm incorrect, I apologize. But anyway, so I think it's Kim Thompson. He was hired by Google, and weird relationship. But he was working at Google to develop the Go programming language. I think this was about like 7-8 years ago. And so he was part of he joined the Google family, basically. And one of the things that Google does is they make all their employees in a certain. It seemed like. I've never worked there, so I can't corroborate, but anyone who has, jump in, please. So the story goes, like, because he was working in this particular department, they wanted him to take a couple of proficiency tests to get the certificates to access, like, the repos and documentation and all of that. One of them was C.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was an offense. He was an offense to his very being that he was being asked to take a proficiency exam in C. And I understand him completely.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no way, like, Google would not make an exception. They would not work with him on that.
Right.
So he just refused to take this proficiency exam. So when he wrote code, he would just email it to someone who did have access to the repo.
Okay.
And they would check it in.
He felt like it was an affront. He's the creator of it. Why would you test him on his own create? Yeah.
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 I mean, it really does not make sense. Like, so it's a story that kind of reveals how bureaucratized Google has become.
Well, I also think, I mean, just, I don't know the history of that, but it off the bat, it seems to me like this is an example where we can misread these people as like deeply eccentric weirdos. Mm-hmm. But from his perspective, I think there is a real legitimate claim here to why he shouldn't take it, because it's like, you are a company that uses my creation, and now you want to gatekeep my ability to use my own creation. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
I think there is a legit ethical reason why he shouldn't do that, why he shouldn't have done that. And, you know, I've kind of had exposure to, you know, free software people and stuff, and they are ethical thinkers. They're like really, they really think a lot about ethics and ownership and usage. So I don't know if that was motivating his thing, but it sounds like the objection might be to the fact that Google was putting gates around the ability to even use this language.
Yeah, even for the creator of the thing that they are making vast,
right,
some lakes of money on.
So he may have been doing it. Like, we as a striver society, you know, we just make everything about what these exterior behaviors and images reflect the individual on the inside. Like, ooh, he's a weirdo. Why wouldn't he just take the damn thing? It doesn't make sense. But maybe he's not thinking about himself. Like, maybe it's not about himself. Maybe this is him saying, no, I'm going to stand by a principle. For the benefit
principle
of
is a
everyone.
Is a good word. I think a hallmark of the obsessive is having a principle, a very strongly held principle that they are not capable of subverting.
Right.
Like adherence to a principle. So
right.
Are we
right.
Talking
meaning
about,
it would be easier for him to do it, but I'm not going to fucking do it because it's wrong.
Yeah. How hard could, I mean, of course he's going to nail that proficiency exam. He could do that in his sleep, right? It's not about,
and it would make
cost him a
easier.
Lot of, yeah, he can just check his code in, not email it to somebody else, mm-hmm. and have them do it. And I mean, that's a hilarious nightmare.
Yeah, but
nightmare.
It's so weird because it's so easy to twist that into thinking that he's being narcissistic or difficult.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's a thing that happens in Striver culture is like, get with it.
Striver culture.
You being an exception, you kind of like standing up to the rules, you questioning what Google's going to say require you to do, which everyone's required to do, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. It,
who do you think you are?
Subverted as a, it gets turned into like a statement, like, who the fuck do you think you are? You arrogant
right.
fuck.
Yeah.
Right. Like, mm-hmm. everyone has to do it. Get with it. Right.
That's such a projection to say that the obsessive and creative is the narcissist.
Yes.
Which I don't
absolutely.
Think they are.
And I think it's when it comes to talking about like just everyone in general, right? I think it's important to kind of keep this line in mind, because part of striving does mean selling out principle, holding principle less valuable than some external validation,
mm-hmm.
right? So even if you striving, it's a carefully modulated personal dance, right? Like, which principles am I actually gonna cheat on to get this other thing that I have decided is more important than this principle?
Right.
That's not a knock. We all have to do it, right? Sometimes I don't feel like wearing shoes. I'm gonna.
Right.
Because it's simply not worth the hassle of getting thrown out of a place or like getting a, you know, stepping on a rock or something. Just because I don't feel like wearing shoes. Like, we all have to compromise with this like society that we live in, right? Striving means you go over and beyond, and you might not even know it. So it's pretty dangerous for an individual, I think, to internalize it too deeply. There, everyone should have some hard lines that they are not willing to see get crossed. Everyone should. I don't even care what lines. It's going to be different from person to person. I think everyone should. That's part of being an adult, a grown-ass, actualized person. You have to have principles that you live by.
Yeah.
Some of them are fungible. Some of them have to be absolute.
That is the end of part one of this two-part podcast episode. If you want to listen to the second part, it's on our Patreon feed. And if you want to, if you're not part of the Patreon, you want to support, patreon.com/planningmaggie.